Okay, this is continuing with Greenstein on 22nd August, 75. So, this 800 kelvins that you just mentioned was...
was our idea of what Jansky had found. That was what was... that was wrong in many ways.
And you were able to make your model such that you got to it.
But beyond reason. I mean, that was almost beyond
reason. But what you finally published was only 30 kelvins. 30,
yeah, and that was heated up appreciably over what it would be in Unabled 3 by a factor of 10 to the 4th increase, you see, in energy density.
Right.
And that's a lot. And to do that, we had to trap the whole radiation of the center of a galaxy in an efficient dust cloud. The other part of it was that we then also knew that if you used very small particles, which my thesis had been about, which would scatter light, which are smaller than a wavelength of light, they're terribly bad radiators. So you had to then take into account the fact that you would have a few, but not many large particles. They would be better radiators, but there wouldn't be enough of them to be opaque. So the whole thing came out as a pretty, if you read the paper, it should never have been published because it didn't get anywhere, but it was started with high hopes and it seemed to have worked.
But now, were you at all concerned with the relatively high radio emission detected at high galactic latitudes? Now, you didn't have a contour map.
No. All we knew was Jansky at that in the 30s, remember.
Right, but you can look at his traces and see that there is stuff outside of the center. It takes a little bit more reduction, which only Reber did later.
And
you could have seen that at high latitudes the radiation is only maybe 1/10, 1/20th of what it is at the center, and of course your stellar density and so forth would be way down. That would hurt an idea like this.
That would sure hurt. Well, if it is down 1/10, and if it were thermal radiation and optically thick cloud, I imagine that would mean that it would have had to be optically thick at, let's say, a couple of kiloparsecs from the plane, which is absolutely unreasonable. The other thing that sort of choked off any serious consideration of the dust model, I think, was the fact that there is very little evidence of dust in the center of galaxies, in the normal sense of galaxies. As you know, there is an enormous excess of dust right in the heart of Cepha galaxies, and maybe in quasars, and M82 and so forth, but we didn't know that at the time. You might have pushed this model to higher temperatures right at the center had you really, the fact was that since I was supposedly an expert on interstellar dust, I could see that in other galaxies, there wasn't any. And we didn't, by the way, have a clear picture of what the center of our galaxy was like. That was a time worse than that. It was still a time when it wasn't certain that our galaxy was like other galaxies. You may not realize.
It was not accepted that we were in a spiral removed from the center completely.
The real trouble was there was still a hangover of the time when people didn't take interstellar dust very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
As a result of which, we seem to live in what was called the Kapteyn universe.
Right.
Way off at the edge, and the globular clusters were centered then 30 kiloparsecs away, and our system was a kiloparsec or two in diameter. And there was the idea maybe that we lived in a cluster of galaxies, where the globular clusters sat around some other object completely, not our spiral, but something else. And you have no idea how ignorant astronomy was at any time in the past, nor how ignorant it is right now.
Right, unless you've been there.
But in fact, I think it's wise to say that this failure only caused me to be permanently interested in radio astronomy. And so,
let me just ask another question before you go on. Were you at all aware of the abstract which R.M. Langer published at an APS meeting, he presented a talk on how Ujansky's measurements might be due to transitions, quantum transitions in dust, charged dust particles.
No, that's a thing I referred to much
but
later.
But you knew nothing about it
not
at that time.
Not at the time. What year was that?
That's 36.
So, okay, it was only an abstract. Just the same time.
Right.
And I wasn't at the meeting, and I didn't hear about it, but we looked into it when we wrote the review,
right,
because then it was getting to be a well-documented subject.
So you got to Yerkes then, and what was your next contact when you...
Well, the next thing was that since we now knew a lot about the emission in the continua of gaseous nebulae that were ionized, the recombination emission on level 3 gives us the emission you see in the visible region, and the recombination level 2 gives the emission beyond the Balmer limit. I studied that, and I wrote a couple of papers on the Orion Nebula and similar objects. And this question of the continuity of this emission with the radio frequency kept coming up. And at some time, and I don't know exactly the sequence, Grotarieva wrote a paper or gave a talk, and you may know the date better than I, in which he said that maybe the emission was due to charge particle
right.
radiation.
Right, this was in the proceedings of the IRE again in 1939.
39.
Or 40.
40, okay.
And he just, at the end, he actually tries to work some of the theory using Eddington's old thing, and he forgets about the Gaunt correction factor.
Yes. That's right. And okay. All right. Well, we heard about this, and I don't actually honestly remember when I met Grote or whether he told me about it or not. But as a consequence of his statement, and it's clear because it's quite a few years later, there's a letter to Nature by Henry, myself, and Keenan on the Free.
46, I think.
And 46, and that's a long interval with the war in between, and that's the obvious reason for it. The point was that we knew Reaver by then. His idea, and I think, by the way, I'm not sure, but that in that paper, in the Nature article, we mentioned something about the recombination lines of large N. I've forgotten that. I'm not sure.
I don't remember that. I'll check.
But because all of this was really still this argument on continuity.
Right.
We knew there were free electrons, and therefore, but the trouble was, by then, two things had happened. I come back. And maybe I can actually get my wife.
Okay.
We now knew, you see, that the radio frequency emission was too hot.
Right.
Because the moment that Grote had moved to slightly higher frequencies, it was getting hotter and hotter. Everybody was out of business because 10,000 was not enough. So I think the actual genesis, even if it's not in the paper, of that idea about computing the free emission from the interstellar gas at 10,000 degrees to see if it would account for the radio emission, was that we had thought of it as the confluence of the high lines.
I see.
You see, it's odd to think of how everything goes backwards at that time, but since classical physics was the way I'd been trained, and quantum physics was a late addition, you treated everything, especially at high quantum numbers and continua, with a classical approximation.
Right.
All you had to do was say the interval between lines was 2hr over n cubed dn, and that was it. So everything, we started on the backward side. And of course, with people chasing the temperature hotter and hotter, it made this whole effort fairly futile, but at least we went through it.
But now we've skipped ahead a bit.
Yeah.
Reaver made this suggestion in the proceedings
and
of the IRE.
And somehow we knew about it.
Right.
I met Reaver, and to be honest, I think I met him in 42. He was a hanger-on at the University of Chicago. He never finished college. Do you know that?
No, I haven't talked with him. I got to spend a lot of time.
He never finished college. He had a great resistance to formal education. He thought anybody who did theory was a nut, and you had to go out and measure. And he told me many years later, and I think the tragic fact about him, the reason he went to these very long wavelengths and went after things that seemed of little real interest, to me at least, was that that was where the power was. Because everything was a one over power. There was more power at low frequencies. You want to go look at lower and lower frequencies. Anyway, he was a very peculiar, interesting, eccentric individual scientist of the great inventor tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere, somehow, out of his work, I think he worked for Admiral Radio or Emerson Electric.
He worked for many different companies.
But during the war, somehow, he built up his stuff.
Right, but okay, but now, were you involved at all when the paper arrived at the Astrophysical Journal?
No, which, when are we talking?
Well, 1940, this was published finally.
Yeah.
It was the same, essentially the same paper that he published in the proceedings of the IRE. Once again, he wanted to communicate with the astronomers.
Yeah, and he is that the one which has a kind of a contour map? Is that... Or is
no, this one only has a rough run with longitude, just a few points.
Yeah.
It was only 44 when he finally had it.
Now, I was involved with the 44 one. The 41...
This is the one where the apocryphal story where Struve sent Kuiper down to see...
I thought that was the 44 paper.
No, that's the 40 paper, the very first one. Okay. Because, you see, he didn't know what to do with it first.
Well, now, I don't know why. Now, then the apocryphal story is really apocryphal because I think I can tell you something that will at least say what it was. Now, Chandrasekhar might know, but I don't think he would care to tell. Maybe I could write him and ask him. I just saw him. Chandra ran the journal with an iron hand, an unknown...
But Struve was the editor then.
Was Struve the editor then?
In 40.
Okay. All right. Boy, you really have me on history, because I was there through all of this, and I don't know dates and times. Well, I'll have to stop.
Well,
I really shouldn't.
Bart Bach has told me his version of this story in 1940, and also...
And he says it's the 40.
Right, and also... Keenan, talked with him, and he gave me his version of it. You might be interested to know that what had happened is that it's not clear exactly how, but what the agreement was that, all right, we'll publish your paper, you seem to really know what you're doing, but leave the theory to us. And so they chopped off that free.
I see.
And then Henier and Keenan, in their 1940 paper, worked it out properly.
Yeah.
And so these two papers appear together in the 1940 Astrophysical Journal.
I see. That's interesting, and it may be that I even knew it, but I didn't remember it. Because
but you weren't involved in this episode.
No. The business about making sure whether he was turning some dial on the back, I find a little hard to believe.
I've never heard that.
Oh, now that
people
was
really thought it might be a fraud.
Yes, I thought that is the story that I thought involved Kuiper.
Huh.
And the reason you see that I put it for the later paper is that Kuiper worked at Harvard in the same electrical engineering lab, which had now grown, on window. Being a classical physicist, a classical astronomer, classical physicist in training, things like dipole scattering and things were things that he would know. And he was, I thought, involved in finding out whether Reber was a fraud or not, because he knew something about radar and high frequency work. And measurements, and therefore, it was, I thought, at that occasion, that it was suggested he go down and watch the needle moving.
Maybe there was a double visit, but certainly Struve himself, in a Sky and Telescope article in 48, describes this initial 1940 visit with Kuiper going down. But there may have been other visits.
Because I began going down very frequently during the mid-years of the war. There was gas rationing, but he had this thing running all the time, this big wooden thing behind his mother's house with the laundry on it. And I liked him, and we talked. And
can you sort of describe the setup some more?
He lived in an old suburb of lower middle class suburb. He was a bachelor. He earned enough money to pay for his meals at his mother's house.
Mm-hmm.
He put the rest in this wooden structure, which carried the dish. And the dish was, I think, carefully and lovingly made.
Oh,
and
yes.
Being in radio communications, maybe radar, I'm not sure, he was able to sneak out some of these high-frequency tubes. And the first high-frequency technology I ever saw with Grotus with what I think were called lighthouse tubes,
mm-hmm.
which are just little ziggurat-shaped things with sections which were rather short and where the electron transfer time wasn't too long. And he would tell me that, of course, that they weren't allowed to tell anybody about it, and he wasn't supposed to have it,
yep.
but he had one, or he had the best, or something
right.
like that. And if you ever get to talk to him, you'll realize this peculiar. He absolutely wouldn't do anything in the straightforward, conventional academic world. He couldn't. But he loved this kind of idea that he could improve his technology, mm-hmm. that he could go to higher frequency. What is it? Didn't he go to 480, 160?
Well, he started off at 3300 and got no signal. Then he went down to 960, I think,
yeah.
or 900. And then he finally went down to 480. No, I think the first time he skipped down to... Oh, geez, now I'm getting mixed up.
To a rather low.
To 160,
frequency.
Right.
I think it's 160, and that
later went up to 480.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
And that's where he detected it finally. But I mean, it's amazing perseverance.
That,
just keep going, you know.
And every damn thing he did himself. He didn't have assistance. I mean, the recording mechanism was primitive. There were all kinds of dials and needles all over the place. And getting the thing running was a major undertaking of tuning things up
yeah.
and hoping the tube wouldn't get noisy and stuff like that, because they had all kinds of limitations.
And he had to work mainly at night, did he not, to avoid auto interference?
It was just I sort of feel that it was a rather ungainly, old-fashioned house. And I think there is a picture somewhere of the back of the house with the antenna there and laundry strung between. But that is how I remember it.
Mm.
And we saw each other moderately frequently, and I liked him, you know, very different. I'd started as a sort of a theoretician for those days. And I just found all of this fascinating, and though I may not have been in and apparently don't really remember that 1940 paper at all, I know that any of the interest in the free-free that I had later, and you say that Penny and Keenan did it in 40, I thought it was later, and I think I'm involved in a paper somewhere there.
The 46 one, yeah.
Well, what was that about? Wasn't that the same?
Well, I can't quite remember what the point of the 46 one was.
Well, maybe the 46 one had the lines then. But in any case, it was clear that something was going on, and Reber was finding it. He was no fraud. And in many ways, one would like to help him, but there was no practical way to help him in a university world.
Yeah. Was there anyone else from astronomy visiting
Henny, him? Henny certainly would have. Henny's dead, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Whether Keenan visited there, I don't know. Did he?
Yeah, he didn't mention visiting there.
Oh, well, I visited.
He certainly talked with him a lot when Reber was taking courses and all.
Yeah, the problem was, you see, that Reber was a dropout from the university.
He did take some courses, didn't he?
Yes.
Graduate courses in astrophysics?
Well, that I know. All graduate courses in astrophysics were given at Yerkes. There was no astronomy department in town except for undergraduate teaching. And since he dropped out in early 40s, late as 41 or something, and went off into industry, I taught one elementary astronomy course there during the war, but I'm pretty sure he wasn't in it.
Where did he drop out from?
I think he tried to go through the University of Chicago.
Oh, really?
Didn't make it.
I see.
Maybe he didn't make a year of it.
Well, I can't remember. I think, once again, it's Keenan who's told me that he did at least sit in on a couple of...
He may have
trying
come
to learn
up to
some
Yerkes,
astrophysics.
Yeah. But it'd have to be at Yerkes.
Yeah, okay.
Because there wasn't any undergraduate...
Okay.
I mean, there was one undergraduate course which during the war was taught by various people. I taught it, I think, in 42. and I'm certain that Grota wasn't in it.
Yeah.
But somehow we kept contacts, and he disappeared into mysteries of radar or radio, and I went off into optical design and with Henny. So there had to be a gap of a few years, but by 44, when things looked a little bit more secure, I am fairly certain that I resumed contact with Reaver. Now, when is the next paper?
Well, his 44 paper presents the complete contour map.
And by then, I was in fairly constant, not constant, but once every few months, would be in touch, and I, for all I know, have letters, but it's mostly visits.
What sort of reception did these 1940 and 44 papers have in the astronomical? And they were getting into the astronomy journals at least. That's a start.
That's a start, and I don't think anybody disbelieved them. On the other hand, they didn't make any sense, because it was clear that if you turned his then respective units into temperatures, that they were outside of anything we understood. And so, in fact, the whole mystery is that the temperature of space in solid form is 3 degrees. If you heat dust very fancily, and if it has high absorptivity and low emissivity, you can get it up to 20 degrees. In dust clouds, we observe it in the infrared, it's up to 70 degrees sometimes.
Right.
But no one had any idea, really, amount of power that there was.
When really was it that the discrepancy was believed to, that it must be a theoretical problem? Because there's some talk at that time about, it's a high temperature, but 100,000 kelvins, could be that if Jansky's measurements are really a little bit high and Reber's is a little bit low.
But was the Reber's temperature corresponding?
Oh, it was a lot less.
Because of the higher frequency.
Right. It's Jansky's that was the real problem.
Yeah, well, with luck, if Reber had kept on going, we could have explained it with our dust model at higher frequency. I remember that just that kind of discussion and plotting, and I think there is this paper, and I think I have it upstairs, so maybe we'll stop for an instant. I remember diagrams with a couple of points representing power and the optically thin free emission.
Right.
And the point, and you just couldn't say they were on the curve.
Oh yeah, I agree.
Let's see the data on that. That just worries me.
Okay.
Continuing, we do find it was in 46, and I think from then on, as more measures were made, people believed calibration in absolute units more, that it was clear that a non-thermal theory was required. And that's about where I would have to leave it for quite a long time, except to say the following. In a very important other thread has to come in as to why astronomers after this period, with or without reference to the publication of the observations by the English, became very excited. And that was the realization of the importance of cosmic rays and magnetic fields in space. This arose largely, for me at least, through the interest of Enrico Fermi in the subject of the origin of the cosmic radiation. He was, I would say, a rare visitor at Yerkes during World War II when he was engaged in the Manhattan District. He was a friend of Chandrasekhar's, and I remember an evening discussion with Fermi and I forget who else giving sort of semi-formal talk about the mystery of the very large amount of energy in the cosmic radiation.
The cosmic rays.
Rays. And whether there were cosmic ray electrons or not was then not known, but the question of the losses was very clear.
Mm-hmm. Now, this was about what time now you're talking?
This is before I left Yerkes, so that's before 48.
Mm-hmm.
So right after this 46 period, people were worrying about acceleration mechanisms, betatron mechanism,
right,
moving magnetic fields, trapping
things. I didn't have these things tightened.
Plasma physics existed already in a kind of sense. And I think it was the interest of really these good theoretical people in the question of whether you could make sense of the otherwise completely mysterious cosmic radiation and the implication of magnetic fields,
right,
which meant something or other, obviously, about radio.
And they were trying to tie it in with what was known about the interstellar medium at that time.
Yeah, and that's right. There was the cloud structure, the interstellar medium, cloud-cloud interactions, and there was a great deal of abstract theory developed by Chandrasekhar on fluctuations and the velocity field of stars and the density field of interstellar gas, the existence of discrete clouds of gas.
Mm-hmm.
So that I would think that a very powerful motive for scientists in astronomy and physics both take the radio emission seriously was while there was no tie yet, and this depended on the Slavsky idea, that it must be something else going on, and there was all the energy in the world available in the cosmic ray particles.
Right.
If anybody could have only said they were electrons, it was fine.
Right.
Bruno Rossi came to Yerkes, this interval I remember, gave a talk about new knowledge on cosmic rays, and he said the one thing that we can say with satisfaction, that is the only thing that is of interest to astronomers about cosmic rays, is the place of origin. Otherwise they're a realm for the physicists where it's, you know, completely screwball. Wrong as he could be, just a year later, and you find interstellar polarization and things like that. So I think this is about a natural stopping point for me here.
Okay, but let me ask you though, what your feeling is on why only you and Bach and maybe Struve saw the value of this early radio astronomer amongst optical astronomers. Do you think it's just that? Do you have any idea?
First of all, look how few papers there were.
Right. It was only Jansky's three papers, and when Reber began
Couple of papers by Reber, which showed the beginning of the picture of the Milky Way. In fact, I remember that another optical gadget designed during the war made it possible to see radiation out to 2 microns. This was the lead sulfide photoconductive cell.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately people try to look with them for the center of our galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there were rival incorrect claims that they had seen it.
I see.
At 1 micron, it was hopeless, but there were good detectors. 2.3 microns get through the atmosphere or whatever, and the Ashman cell still worked.
So you're saying that there was interest in the non-optical regimes.
But
they didn't know how to do anything, though.
Right. 1 micron was the absolute limit of photoelectric photometry before the photoconductive devices. It was terribly bad. Photographic plates had 1,000 times lower sensitivity at 1 micron than they did at 0.5 micron.
Right.
And they also had to be specially handled. So we were doing the best we could with the very limited technology. I don't know if you know this, but somewhere in the mid-30s, or late-30s time of the story I told you begins, a physicist student at the University of Wisconsin was persuaded by a professor there who was using old-fashioned electrometers and some kind of Koblenz photoelectric surface to apply the methods of modern physics. And this fellow's name was Albert Whitford, who later became director of the Lick Observatory, was, to my knowledge, the first man to use an amplifier with a photocell for astronomy. It just seems so ridiculous. But on the other hand, you've got to remember how primitive science was.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all very well, the photoelectric cell was found by Einstein when 19... I understood. Yeah. 7, 9
something like
or something. Yeah. DuBridge wrote a book about it in the 30s.
That ends the interview with Greenstein on 22 August 75.